Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Anantanand Rambachan, who is the author of Pathways to Hindu-Christian Dialogue, about which we'll speak today. Anant, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Raj. It's a joy and it's an honor to spend this time with you. Thank you for inviting me.
You're most welcome. So as one might surmise, the genesis of this book probably wasn't, you know, one afternoon 5 years ago. One imagines perhaps there was a journey, whether intellectual, personal, social. Could you tell us a bit about, you know, what led you to this book?
Well, thank you, Raj. I think it's an excellent question. And I think this book in so many ways is the story of an important dimension of my own life. I was born on the island of Trinidad and Tobago. My great-grandfather migrated there in the middle of the 19th century, you know, to serve as replacement labor for emancipated African slaves. He was 19 years old. So I am a fourth generation Hindu born in Trinidad. And as you may well know, Raj, Trinidad is a very small island off the coast of the South American mainland. But what is distinctive about the island is its religious and cultural diversity, and which means that in the village in which I grew up, I had neighbors from the Christian tradition, from Islam, from African traditional religions. And so I grew up in the midst of people and practitioners of other religions, and I went to schools where I've always sat side by side with friends from other religious traditions. So the experience of religious diversity was very early in my life. It was not, you know, we were not practitioners at that age, as you could imagine, of interreligious dialogue as a formal activity. This came a little bit later for me. And it started during my years in graduate school in the United Kingdom. I did all of my graduate studies at the University of Leeds. And during the first year of my PhD program, I was invited to participate in interreligious conference in India. And the title was Religious Resources for a Just Society, Hindu-Christian Meeting. This was in a small North Indian village, Himalayan village of Rajpur. And they brought together over 30 Hindus and Christians, scholars, religious leaders, practitioners, to talk about justice. This was convened, I must add, by the World Council of Churches in Geneva. I had never, you know, thought systematically about justice in the Hindu tradition. I had very traditional training. I had spent 3 years in India, living in a Hindu monastery, studying in a very traditional way with Hindu teachers, reading sacred texts like Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita and Brahma Sutras, studying Sanskrit and practicing religious disciplines, but had never really given much thought to the social dimensions of religion, and especially to issues of justice. So this conference in Rajpur, I was a young student, had a very deep impact on me. It was an eye-opening conference and challenged me in significant ways to consider the social structures that emerge from my own tradition that many experience as oppressive and as not honoring or affirming their dignity. This conference at Rajpur initiated for me what was and what continues to this day to be, Raj, a very significant entry into the field of interreligious dialogue, interreligious studies, interreligious action. I have continued to work with the World Council of Churches and other Christian and also other multi-religious organizations. And so I want to say that, to answer your question, to respond to your question by saying that this book, therefore, I could easily describe as one of the important fruits of my experience and my life in interreligious dialogue, and especially in Hindu-Christian dialogue.
Mm. You know, that's what one suspects from the title, and certainly that's what one learns from the introduction. There are a great many intellectual enterprises, and intellectual enterprises need to be engaged, you know, on their own terms with particular methodologies and histories of ideas in mind. Nevertheless, for one to dedicate one's lifeblood to turning out a book on a topic beyond merely intellectual curiosity, which is noble and important and very much real, there's a reason why we care about this. But in a book such as this, that reason why we care is all the more evident, in terms of the book is a result of sustained reflection and ideation, but it can only be really empowered by life experience on various sides of encounters. And so thank you for sharing that.
Yes.
What would you say, is the overarching thrust, theme, message, gist of the book? And perhaps in tandem, really in any order, my questions are all meant to be generative, so whatever feels natural to you. Where would you place it in terms of, are there others of its kind? Is this a burgeoning field? Is this new? You know, could you perhaps address those overarching streams?
Yes, thank you, Raj. I think that you put your finger very well on what my approach in this book is all about, in the sense that I heard you saying that this is not a highly theoretical book about Hindu-Christian dialogue, or indeed about dialogue. It is a book about the experience and practice of dialogue. So in this book, I write about a lot of the experiences that I have had, in this case, with Christians in various contexts of dialogue. So I'm writing as a practitioner who is deeply engaged in dialogue. I do not think that in recent decades, Raj, I would have to look at it more carefully, but at least perhaps four decades or more, has there been a book specifically on Hindu-Christian dialogue written by a Hindu practitioner? There may be other kinds of books on Hindu-Christian studies. For example, you know, the field of comparative theology is a growing field, and you have many well-known practitioners, especially on the Christian side. I know you have, I'm surely interviewed Frank Clooney about his books on Hindu-Christian comparative studies. But as far as Hindu-Christian dialogue is concerned, I think there are many reasons. This has not been a field in which Hindus themselves have generated reflective theological works. So I think that this is the lens I am bringing as a Hindu practitioner in dialogue. How do I experience and where do I see the future? Where do I see the challenges? Where do I see the possibilities of Hindu-Christian dialogue going into the future? And you know, again, because of my experience of Hindu-Christian dialogue, I'm not overlooking or minimizing, you know, I'm not naive about the theological differences between Hindus and Christians. I don't want to trivialize these, nor am I unaware of the tensions, especially contemporary tensions between Hindus and Christians in various parts of the world and in India. So I am writing this book because, in spite of these challenges, or because of these challenges and the lingering scars of history, I believe that there are possibilities for a meaningful future, for meaningful future relationships between Hindus and Christians. And this is what I want to lift up. I hope this is a hopeful book. Raj, I think that, you know, these are two of the world's major religious traditions. The Hindu tradition is now a global tradition. Here in North America, you know, we are a minority in the midst of overwhelming Christian communities, and this is true of other parts of the world. And therefore, we have to build relationships. We have to build relationships that enable us to construct communities in which we live, to be communities of justice, to be communities of love, to be communities that care for each other. And I see, in this case, my focus is on Hindu-Christian dialogue, but this could be extended. I see dialogue and relationships as vital to the task and to the work of community building. And this is what I want to lift up in this book.
Mm. Indeed, Frank Clooney has been on the podcast. Indeed, he, as evidenced in a quote that of his I'll read about your book in a moment, it appears that he would corroborate your characterization of the book insofar as he writes, let's see, here it is. Mm. He speaks of you, that he shows us in a simple and direct way, free of jargon and from the heart, the ever greater value of dialogue in today's fractured and intolerant world. Hindus and Christians and believers in every tradition will want to travel the wise and serene path Ramachan clears for us. Lovely. So tell us a little bit, or characterize that path for us. Certainly there's no need to lose sight of the forest for the trees, but characterize the path insofar as what are some of the obstacles or challenges that that you face to dialogue? What are some of the inroads? What are some of the strategies, perhaps, in whatever order you'd like?
Yes. I think the the challenges are many, Raj, and so also are the possibilities. And I wanted to lift up both of these in this book. So among the challenges, I think we have to deal with history. And Hindus have historically encountered the Christian tradition and almost entirely in the context of proselytizing programs. In other words, I think that if you were to ask a Hindu layperson about Christianity, it is very likely that he or she will say that, will speak about conversion and the agenda of conversion that they encounter with the Christian church. This is a very contemporary way of thinking about Christianity. And so that becomes a very significant obstacle to dialogue or to entering into dialogue, in the sense that Hindus don't encounter the Christian tradition as a tradition that is eager to learn about and to learn from the Hindu tradition, or to learn from Hindus. And so this is an impediment to Hindus entering into dialogue. Now, my experience may be a limited one, and I am, you know, I would humbly admit that, but I have had significant experiences, you know, over the last four decades with Christian friends in dialogue, who come to dialogue with humility, who come to dialogue with a deep desire to share and to learn, for mutual sharing and learning, who come with deep knowledge and respect for the Christian tradition. So the story of proselytization, is there. It's a historical reality. But I want to also say there is this growing story about Christians who are deeply interested in learning from the Hindu tradition without the prominent intent or agenda of conversion. The second obstacle, I would say, Raj, which is perhaps related to the first, is my experience is in dialogue is usually I would find that Christians come into dialogue, you know, they are well trained in their tradition. Most of these have had seminary, Christian seminary, or graduate training in the Christian tradition. And as well, they also come with significant knowledge of the Hindu tradition. So they are scholars with this dual expertise in their old traditions and in the Hindu tradition. Whereas on the Hindu side, for historical reasons, we have not exemplified any deep scholarly interest in Christianity. And there may be very practical reasons for that, right? Because one would have to ask, you know, where does that kind of scholarly interest take me? What kind of professional possibilities are there for a Hindu who commits himself to the study of Christian theology? So you have, as you know, in the academic world, you have a significant number of teachers in the United States, and I'm sure it must be the same in Canada and other parts of the world, who come from Christian backgrounds and teach the Hindu tradition. But we do have the reverse is not true. And that's probably something to think about and to address, because I mean, dialogue does require a certain equality or leveling in the field. And right now, I think that is a imbalance. So, you know, there is that suspicion about dialogue as a program of evangelization. And there is also the absence of serious scholarly study of the Christian tradition. So In other words, when there is the absence of serious scholarly study of another tradition, then what becomes predominant are certain stereotypes of the tradition that becomes an impediment to the development of good relationships. But I think that as far as opportunities are concerned, Raj, I think that, and I want to say that, I want to emphasize that Hindus who live like we do outside of India, in Canada or the United States, in the Caribbean, in South Africa, in Fiji, in Mauritius, who live so closely in diverse communities, we have a special opportunity now to build these deep relationships, to deepen knowledge of each other, and to deepen relationships, to build civic resources for our communities.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Speaking of knowledge of each other, what might adherents of one of these faiths learn from adherents of the other, i.e., what can Hindus learn from Christians? What can Christians learn from Hindus in your perspective?
It's, of course, it's a fine question, Raj, because two of the chapters in my book are dedicated to these questions. What can Hindus learn from Christianity, and what can Christians learn from Hinduism? And I identify, and here's where we can talk about, you know, it leads very nicely from your last question. It can... These I think, are where opportunities really lie. And so we should be asking ourselves exactly the question that you are presenting to me. What can we as Hindus learn from Christianity? And what can Christians learn from the Hindu tradition? So I have identified, you know, we have seen, again, you know, I could respond to your question historically. And we have many significant Hindu figures, you know, from the time of the first encounter with Christianity, who have taken Christianity very seriously, but not naively. So you have people like Ram Mohan Roy, like Keshav Chandra Sen, like Swami Vivekananda, like Mahatma Gandhi, who responded very positively to the figure of Jesus, but made this fascinating move very early in the history of that encounter and rejected institutionalized Christianity. They distinguished the teacher from the institution that was formed in the teacher's name. In other words, they saw the institution of Christianity as enmeshed in colonialism, enmeshed in imperialistic attitudes, but they didn't attribute those kinds of attitudes to Jesus, and therefore they came as learners, and I think all of them spoke a great deal about his compassion, his care, and especially his commitment to the to the marginalized, the poor, the powerless, the imprisoned, the victims of the imperialistic Roman Empire. And we could identify, you know, so well the what they took back from their encounters with him. It was not always something new, but it was an encounter that led them to look back at their own traditions and to retrieve sometimes, in so many instances, to retrieve from those traditions resources that they had perhaps overlooked. And that's one of the valuable outcomes of dialogue, where the encounter with another tradition can help you to see your own tradition much more clearly, both in its positive possibilities, but also to see it more critically. So I think that there is historically a lot to learn from Jesus. In this book, Raj, I identify something very important. You know, I identify my own learning from the Christian tradition, and I identify the ways in which Christian liberation theology has influenced my own study and writing on Hinduism. One of my earlier works, A Hindu Theology of Liberation, is my attempt to construct liberation theology from Hindu places of meaning, and which was inspired in many ways by the work of Christian liberation theologies, including people like James Cone and others. But I also identify in this book, Raj, one very important place of learning for me. And you know, I spoke about the many, many rich and diverse and varied images of God that we have in the Hindu tradition, the countless faces of the divine that we have in the richness of the Hindu tradition. But what I found to invite my reflection, to be challenging for me, is the Christian face of God as a suffering God, as a crucified God, a God who died, you know, who was crucified and mocked and jeered and did not respond with hate or violence. You know, and I ask myself, you know, what does that face of God, what does that vision of God bring to me as a Hindu? Well, how does it complement or challenge or enrich the many faces of God that I know that are meaningful to me in the Hindu tradition? So I think that's for me personally, that's a continuing place of learning. And on the other side, Raj, what can Christians learn from Hindus? I think that there are many. I think Hinduism radically challenges certain predominant Christian understandings of God as a superpersonal being existing outside of the cosmos, outside of the universe. I think what is theologically a powerful teaching coming down from ancient times to the present across Hindu traditions is an understanding of the divine who is here and now, in whom everything exists and in whom all, who exists in everything and in whom all exists, you know, a very deep and profound panentheism that sometimes, you know, in some traditions have gone into non-dualism. God always here and now, we are inseparable from God. So I think that strong affirmation of the reality of the divine in all and all in the divine, it's a powerful place where deep learning, I think, can take place. I'm already seeing so many, I mean, Christian theologians who are taking this teaching seriously and looking, also looking back into the Christian tradition to find new ways of thinking about the divine that does not push the divine outside of the universe as a superpersonal being. I think it also transforms Christian thinking about the natural world, because the natural world in the Hindu tradition also, you know, evokes sanctity, evokes reverence. We are a deep part of the natural world and not a world that is objectified and separate from us. And when a Christian begins to engage with the Hindu tradition in this way, I think many things, there are many new possibilities. What is the human problem and how it is, the idea of, you know, the Hindu idea of Jivan Mukti, liberation here in this life, and not only as a post-mortem. Because if God is here and now, then it opens up the possibility that knowing God here now is also an experience of liberation, that liberation is not awaits the death of the physical body. And as you know, the idea of living liberation is a very powerful teaching in many of our Hindu traditions. So I think, Raj, that there are such rich possibilities for mutual learning. And this is really what I want to encourage in this book. I want us to take each other's traditions seriously and not overlook our differences, but what can we learn from each other? How do our deep theological insights and our experiences of practicing our traditions can mutually enrich us? How can we learn together from each other? And there are two chapters in my book where I try to lift up, of course, they're not exhaustive, but speaking from my own experience, I lift up what I think are important places of learning for me. But, you know, to do that, Raj, we have to come with a humility also. We have to come into relationships of humility with each other.
That last point, I rarely interrupt guests, but the next question I had, I'll ask in the midst of what you're saying now, because you're veering in that direction as it is. And just as a quick aside, the vast majority of my teaching is continuing studies. I taught at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies for a decade, and now I'm doing online continuing studies for the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. And so one of the thought experiments, depending on the class and the context that posited, is imagine a global culture, perhaps, you know, secular in some sense, but coming from a religious tradition. Imagine a global culture that stems from a different religious tradition. For example, we are now realizing as a civilization that we can't destroy the planet by just moving from A to B, day in and day out, etc. So would a civilization that hailed from Shinto or Native American or Hindu traditions have come up with transportation vehicles which relate to the planet in this way? And every civilization, every tradition will have strengths and weaknesses and different applications. And so these are fascinating thought experiments. But to the point that I interrupted you regarding the humility, my next question was, an individual who is interested, earnestly interested in dialogue, in Hindu-Christian dialogue, mm-hmm. What are the marks of such a one? What is required of such a one?
Well, I would put humility at the, not necessarily top of the list, but certainly as one of the important prerequisites for fruitful dialogue. And one of my own strong motivations for dialogue, which is, if I look to my own tradition and I ask myself, as a Hindu, why would I want to engage in a dialogue of learning with my Christian brothers and sisters, or my Islamic brothers and sisters, or my Buddhist brothers and sisters? Because there is this deep teaching articulated in so many powerful verses in Upanishads and other texts that, for example, you know, I'm thinking of this one of my favorite texts from Taittiriya Upanishad, which defines the infinite one, the sacred one, as that from which all words return, having failed to grasp, you know, yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasa saha. Or you have the Kena Upanishad, you know, those beautiful apophatic texts in Kena Upanishad, that which the mind cannot know, but because of which the mind knows, that which the eyes do not see, but because of which the eyes see. For me, the fundamental teaching here, which is why I'm lifting up the virtue of humility, is that when we come to consider the infinite, the limitless, we can never be comprehensive in our understanding. It is always more than we can know, more than we could understand. And if that is very deep in our hearts, then we have no choice but to open ourselves attentively and mindfully to what others' experiences and to what others have to teach. The only reason why we would not do that is somehow if we think that, you know, the words that I have used about the infinite are the only words and they are the most comprehensive words and there is nothing more to be said and nothing more to be known. But we know that is not true. We know that is not true, Raj. And we can all be enriched if we humbly enter into dialogue with each other. So that's why I would want to say humility is a fundamental prerequisite for dialogue. We must listen to each other because none of us have the truth in its fullness. It would be a truth that is fully comprehended and described by any human being would not be the ultimate truth that is described in any of our traditions, if I would put it in that way. And therefore, dialogue. This is a justification for me as a Hindu theologian, a justification for dialogue. You know, there is also that often quoted text. I'm sure you know it so well because you would have not missed it, you know. Ekam sat vipra bahuda vadanti. The truth or reality is one. Wise people speak of it differently. Vipra. I meditate a lot on that text and I've heard it, you know, since I was young. And then it struck me some time ago that that sentence says that those who speak differently are vipra, they are wise. That is the wise who speak differently. In other words, that different theological ways of speaking are not because people are ignorant or uninformed, but sometimes the different ways of speaking also reflect deep wisdom. It is the vipraha bahuda viranti. It is the vipra who are speaking differently, the wise who are speaking differently. And if we bring that, lens to say, oh, my goodness, you know, this tradition has endured. This tradition has won the hearts of so many. It has responded to human needs. Therefore, what are they saying? What is the wisdom that has, you know, that explains the commitment to Christianity or to Islam or to Buddhism? What are the wise people of this tradition saying, the vipraha? I think it opens our hearts and minds to being receptive to the wisdom offered by these traditions.
I did my BA and master's at Toronto. Then I went to Calgary to do my PhD. And so I made a number of connections there. And
yes,
many of them are still very much active folks that I met. And I'll just share in passing, there's this one gentleman who is a Roman Catholic priest I got to know relatively well. And to this day, every couple of months or so, we'll get on a call and speak about life, share experiences. He may ask questions and he has this fascinating perspective that I think resonates with what you were saying, in that there's no interest in, he doesn't have an interest in conversion or vetting or ascertaining. I mean, he's well aware that I have a very universalist bent and I study world religions and et cetera, et cetera. And he said to me one day, I come to these calls for the wisdom you're able to share. And then I thought, let me use this as a as an opportunity for ethnographic research into, you know, the human experience. And I thought, well, do you mean just the wisdom that you find corresponds to the wisdom of Christian teachings? And what he said fascinated me, that he would have that perspective, because obviously he's a Roman Catholic priest and he has a particular lens to which he views the world and a particular commitment, etc. He said to me, there is wisdom that you, how did he put it? There's wisdom that comes out of your mouth that can only come out of your mouth because of your perspective on reality. And yet that wisdom helps me to understand Christianity better.
Yes. Well, and that's
that was a moment that stayed with me.
That's a wonderful, wonderful story, Raj. I'm glad that you shared that, because as an addition to what I, you know, that Rig Veda text, you know, the wise people speak differently. And he's coming to you to listen to your different speech.
Yeah, it's a two-way street, and we often muse that, you know, there's not one culture, creed, tradition, religion, sect that has a monopoly on wisdom, and wisdom wells up. You know, it's ubiquitous, and etc. etc. Enough about me and my pseudo.
No,
ethnography on this, this podcast.
I appreciate that story very much. I mean, it's powerful, but it's also quite rare, and that's what makes it stands out, that someone can come to you. I mean, you said a well-trained theologian and can say, you know, I'm coming to you because I want to hear what you are saying. It is your different experience, your different insight that I find most enriching. And I think that's a very good, you know, lesson for Hindu-Christian dialogue, or for dialogue on the whole. Because if our disposition, Raj, is only to listen to the other or what he or she is saying that we already know, then, you know, we're not going to be enriched. But we have to listen so deeply, especially to what is different in the other's experience or the other's words. And that takes a very special opening of the heart and the mind and a willingness to be challenged. You know, the dialogue is not, you know, we don't go into dialogue necessarily, and we should not regard dialogue as successful only when we agree. That would be very superficial, Raj.
And it needs to be a two-way street, certainly. As we're closing for today, I wonder, is there anything else about the book that you hoped or you'd like for us to touch on?
I hope, Raj, I mean, this is a kind of book that I am hoping would not only be used in, you know, in higher education spaces of learning. I hope that it would be read by Hindus and Christians who live in communities side by side with each other, and looking for ways to connect with each other, looking for ways to speak and approach each other, even around the topics that are controversial. Because I don't think, you know, we need to build relationships, quite rightly. I think those are also at the foundation of good dialogue. Good dialogue requires good relationships. And it is those relationships, when they are well formed, that allows us to speak truthfully and to speak without fear to each other. So I'm hoping that, you know, that this book can be a catalyst to such coming together, to such relationships, that allows us and gives us the space to talk about matters of controversy, for example, you know, the history of conversion, to speak about violence. In this book, I'm also addressing Hindu-Christian dialogue on caste, Hindu-Christian dialogue and Hindu nationalism, because I think that a good dialogue also requires deep honesty. We don't deepen our relationships by avoiding the issues that are there in our mind, but which we can't speak to each other in friendship.
Oh, what a lovely thought upon which to end our dialogue for now. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you for this opportunity, Raj. I really enjoyed this this conversation. You made it very hospitable and easy for me to chat with you.
You're most welcome. I've been told that I'm user-friendly, and it's good to know that I put people at ease, particularly insofar as I do life guidance work, but I'm not academicing. So that's good. For those listening, of course.
I hope I have the opportunity to meet you in person sometime.
Stranger things have happened. We'll continue chatting after I close. Just stay on for a sec. For those listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Anantanand Rambachan on this fascinating new and perhaps even practical book on pathways to Hindu-Christian dialogue. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep seeking out the perspectives of others of different stripes, and in hopes they may enrich your own. Take care.